Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Today, we're sitting, waiting to hear how the U.S. Supreme Court is going to rule on same-sex marriage. That decision will come down sometime before the end of the month. That could be the biggest news to come from the High Court since January 22, 1973. And here's what CBS Newsman anchorman Walter Cronkite told us what happened on that day.
From CBS News headquarters in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional. There was, of course, other reaction. Cardinal Cook, the Catholic Archbishop of New York, called the decision a shocking action, and Cardinal Kroll of Philadelphia termed it an unspeakable tragedy.
A lot has happened since that day in 1973. Abortion has become the issue in American politics. It is the cornerstone plank for the Democrats and the Republicans. And despite many attempts and strategies, Roe v. Wade still stands, but maybe doesn't stand quite as tall. We're talking about the status of a woman's right to a legal abortion in America. We invite you into our conversation. The number to call is 210-614-8980, and you can email questions and comments to The Source at tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. And we got a tweet already from Michael. He says, as far as abortion goes, people should mind their own business. Not in favor of abortion, then don't get one. My body, my business. So if you want to respond to that, give us a call, 210-614-8980. And with us to talk about this is Mary Ziegler. She's the author of the book, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. It's published by Harvard University Press, and she is also a professor of law at Florida State University College of Law. Mary, welcome to The Source.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The lost history? I didn't know we lost a history about this abortion thing. I thought it was pretty well documented.
Well, I thought that, too, when I was a law student. But what I found was that we had made a lot of unfounded assumptions about what Roe v. Wade did and then really how we got where we are today. And that's where the project started. I assumed that there was such a book. I looked for it when I was in my second year of law school. It didn't exist. And then eventually I was foolish enough to write it. So that's why I'm here with you now.
So what Roe v. Wade did, what the Supreme Court actually decided it was going to do. What is that?
Well, I think what was confusing was that everyone blames a lot of the dysfunction of contemporary abortion politics on the Roe decision. So the idea, for example, that there's no possible compromise, not just on abortion, but also on other gender issues, people think was attributable to Roe. Justice Ginsburg, who's generally very pro-choice, blames the fact that the anti-abortion movement is as powerful as it is and as committed as it is on Roe.
She said it came too early. She said it came too soon, that there should have been more of a transitional period towards it.
And that it should have been based on equality rather than privacy. So a lot of people, from Justice Scalia to Justice Ginsburg, say that if we want to understand how we got into this mess, we can blame the Supreme Court. And what I found was that the story is much messier than that and in a lot of ways more interesting than that. And immediately after Roe, there was actually more possibility for compromise on other gender issues. There were different ways to be pro-choice and pro-life than there are now. And when things did get really polarized, a lot of other people shouldered the blame, not just the Supreme Court.
So it was a 7-2 decision. Justice Blackwood penned it, and he took a very much an approach of looking at a doctor's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so why is that important?
I think it's important partly because it shows how much ordinary people can change what the Supreme Court decisions actually mean to us and even to the Supreme Court. So most people, when they think of Roe, they think of a woman's right to choose. They don't think of a doctor's right to do much of anything. But over time, for their own reasons, both pro-life and pro-choice people began talking about it only in terms of what women had a say in. And ultimately, the Supreme Court itself has begun doing the same thing. And in recent opinions, they focus much more heavily on the woman and, in fact, have more or less downplayed any constitutional interest physicians have to the point that people are shocked by it. So it gives us a sense of how ordinary people can make a difference in how big blockbuster constitutional decisions are understood, like the same-sex marriage opinion that's coming to us probably any time now.
Now, the decision, Roe decision, was also very focused on the health of the mother and not of the unborn child. But we see, and they said that states cannot make laws that would place the life of the unborn child above the life of the mother, but the rights of the mother. But we've seen so many of those laws pass and upheld, things like questions of 24-hour waiting periods and fetal pain and the 20 weeks like we have here in Texas right now. So how do we get there?
Well, one of the things that's fascinating is that the strategy that brought us really to the brink of the Texas case that the Supreme Court might take soon was developed after Roe. And ironically, it was a pro-life strategy that depended on the courts. So initially, as you can imagine, pro-life people wanted to protect the rights of the unborn child. That's, after all, what the movement was about. But soon they realized that a big constitutional amendment, a home run, wasn't going to happen. So they began instead to whittle away at the right that Roe created. So they would go to the courts and say, hey, look, this law is okay under Roe, but it protects the unborn child just a little bit more. And they kept doing this. They called this incrementalism. So instead of going for the home run, you would just try to get on base, and you would move inch by inch by inch until Roe v. Wade would fall under its own weight. And this strategy was invented in the period I'm writing about in the book, but it really has taken on a life of its own since then, and it's become kind of the dominant strategy that you see in all the laws you just described, the 20-week laws, the fetal pain laws, the waiting period laws, the hospital admitting privileges laws. It's really been the blueprint for the movement's success since the mid-70s.
Right, but still, at the same time, they are also pursuing a strategy of trying to stack the court with conservatives that one day would rule against Roe v. Wade.
Oh, absolutely. And the ultimate goal, obviously, is, well, the real ultimate goal actually would be a ban on abortion nationwide, not just the overruling of Roe v. Wade. But the first step in that is the overruling of Roe v. Wade, and that's obviously a two-part strategy. It's not just getting the right laws passed in the states. It's getting the right people in the White House who choose the right judges to hear the cases. So right. You're absolutely right. It's a two-part strategy.
And overturning Roe v. Wade would mean giving the abortion fully back to the states.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and reasonable people, I think, can disagree about how much of a difference at this point it would mean to overrule Roe. There certainly are some restrictions that seem to be off the table for now. For example, like spousal consent restrictions. The Supreme Court's been pretty hostile to those. But it would give the states pretty much entirely free rein to do what they wanted with abortion rather than having to kind of get the green light from the Supreme Court the way they do theoretically now.
Right. We're talking about the book After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. We're speaking with the author, Mary Ziegler. She is also a professor of law at the Florida State University College of Law. We invite you into our conversation. Where do you see these laws headed? Where do you think the future is of Roe v. Wade? Is Roe v. Wade now practically toothless in America due to some of this incrementalism that we've seen that's been very successful in states, particularly here in Texas, which now has some of the most restrictive abortion regulations anywhere in the country? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX, back in 1 minute. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX, January 22nd, 1973. That's the day that the Supreme Court ruled that states could not prevent a woman from having an abortion. The Roe v. Wade decision has sent shockwaves through the nation. It still rattles today. So what has happened after Roe? After Roe, that's the name of the book penned by Mary Ziegler, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. And let's get a caller on the air. The number is 210-614-8980 if you want to call in. And Sawyer is here. Sawyer, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say, you know, if we lived in an ideal world, you know, there wouldn't be abortions. But I think you know, we kind of just have to face the reality of the fact is that people do get abortions and people are always going to get abortions, whether or not there's a safe, legal way to do it. It's always going to happen. So do we, you know, remove the ability for them to get safe abortions, or do we, you know, make them resort to doing things like going across to Mexico and getting them via unsafe ways, or, you know, trying to Google self-abortions? You know, it just, I don't know. It baffles me that people can just, just, you know, ignore the reality of the situation. You know,
sure.
Ideally there wouldn't be abortions.
All right. So
the reality is that there are.
I got your point. Thank you for your call. So he's saying this because you outlaw abortion doesn't mean you're going to get rid of it. In fact, when you look at statistics around the world, countries that have the most restrictive abortion laws are where abortion rates are the highest. And countries like in the Western Europe, where abortion is the most freely available and contraception is freely available, they have the lowest abortion rates, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So go ahead.
Oh, no, I think that's right, and I think that argument often gets lost now because we live so many decades away from Roe, right? I mean, people forget what Roe said, and people certainly forget what the world was like before the decision. And we've had debates in a lot of states about legalizing drugs sort of along the same lines, that it's not worth prohibiting something that people are going to do anyway because you're just going to be channeling behavior into more dangerous places with less qualified practitioners. And I think that there's a real danger of that happening, even if abortion gets more restricted.
Right, but I don't know if Bill Clinton coined this, but he seemed to use it quite a bit, that he wanted to see abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. And so is that part of your research found?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, that became a thing later. So one of the things in the 70s was that both pro-life and pro-choice people wanted to make abortion rare by giving women better alternatives. So this was kind of the big government solution, if you will. So giving women free daycare, better health care, more protection from discrimination at work, so they weren't feeling pressured to have an abortion if they didn't want to. Now a lot of the alternatives tend to go the other way because welfare-based solutions are unpopular. So I think that idea of making abortion safe, legal, and rare was very popular on the pro-choice side throughout time, and even in the past on the pro-life side, except certainly not the legal part, but rare, like undermining the motivation for abortion was something that resonated for a lot of people. But I think the types of solutions we pursue in making abortion rare have changed a lot since the 70s.
Let's get another caller on the air, and our phone lines are open. You're invited to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Catherine is on the line. Catherine, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that I think all the discussion and all the laws and all the religious arguments and everything else are going to be really moot with all the discoveries that science and biologists are making about the fetus and its development.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean, Catherine? Like,
do you mean, Catherine, the changing age of viability? Is that?
No. I mean that people say, you know, like it doesn't feel pain, and it's not really important as a organism, but scientists are showing that it's by the time, I mean, the woman doesn't even know she's pregnant, and the fetus looks like a little tiny person with a little heartbeat and brain waves and everything else, and I don't think most people understand that. They think that it's just a blob.
Okay, Catherine, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for calling
in.
And so the viability issue, that was part of the original Roe v. Wade decision, Mary.
Right. And that has been, I think that was one of the kind of biggest stumbling blocks for pro-choice people after Roe, in the sense that the date of viability, at least with intensive medical intervention, has moved. I think the New England Medical Journal recently had a piece estimating that at least a small group of children could survive at 22 weeks with aggressive medical intervention. So even if we assume that the Supreme Court's going to preserve some version of Roe, or at least it's Casey, the latest interpretation of Roe, it's going to do that with this viability caveat. That's an important point.
So it seems like what Catherine, the caller, was kind of getting towards was the personhood establishment.
Right, and the role of science, too.
Right, and so we've had opportunities for voters to weigh in on personhood, and it's failed when it's gone to the polls. We saw that mm-hmm. in Mississippi and South Dakota. It failed twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go to the people, there seems to still be a lot of support for abortion.
Yeah, and personhood is an interesting thing because even in the 70s and now, when you show people images of the unborn child, it really speaks to them. And I think Catherine was getting at that point. And in fact, a lot of the people, when I did these 100 oral histories for the book, a lot of the people I talked to were people who would have seen themselves as Democrats, but they came to be pro-life because they saw these images. So on the one hand, they're very powerful. On the other hand, when you ask voters kind of in general to take the next step and ban abortion because of personhood, that hasn't worked, and it didn't work in the 70s, and it hasn't worked now, which is in some ways why we're seeing incrementalist strategies, because those are much more palatable for a public that I think is ambivalent about abortion.
70% of Americans do not want to see Roe v. Wade overturned, according to some recent polling. Let's get Ann on the line. She's called in. Ann, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate this discussion, and I'm deeply troubled about the way things are going with regard to incrementalism. I worked for a nonprofit organization that was over 80 years old, who originally started out as the classic unwed mother's home, moved on and placed all of those babies for adoption. Then the reality that most young women were keeping their babies, so we provided housing for pregnant and parenting teens. The thing that distresses me so much is the staunch pro-lifers are not lining up to adopt the children in state foster care, the children that have been removed from their home because of abuse and neglect. They have, you know, have multiple physical and emotional problems, but you don't see pro-life people lining up to adopt these children.
All right, Ann, got your point. Thank you so much for calling in. Another caller, Wayne. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest addressed in her book, as part of the lost history of the discussion, the fact that during the 70s and 80s, there were a number of left-wing groups that were pro-life and progressive organizations and a lot of Democrats for Life and Feminists for Life. I'm wondering
Absolutely.
If you addressed any of that in history.
Okay, Wayne, thanks for the call.
I think that speaks actually to both of your questions, because what I found was that in the 70s, there were a lot of pro-lifers who were Democrats, and they weren't Democrats in the sense of union Democrats. They were really liberal in what we consider a pretty deep sense, and because of that, they were pursuing the kinds of things it seems that pro-lifers would pursue, right, like protections for unwed mothers, laws funding things like free daycare for women or free neonatal care. A lot of the most famous pro-life members of Congress were Democrats, and the converse was true, too, that there were a lot of famous Republicans who were pro-choice. So part of the story of, I think, how we got into today's mess is a story about how abortion became a political issue, which it wasn't after Roe. Both presidential candidates avoided it for a while. But once that happened, the conflict really escalated. So, yeah, the book really does touch on that, and I think that speaks in part to why things are such a mess now.
I remember, Mary, when I was working in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, and Ronald Reagan was in office, and he came into office as a pro-life president, but still mm-hmm. he kept the pro-life movement at arm's length, didn't make personal appearances at their events. Maybe he would call in, but not really, actually be there. I mean, what did that mm-hmm. say?
Well, I think at that point, the alliance of the Republican Party and the pro-life movement was still new and kind of tenuous. It was a troubled marriage. And people didn't know yet, I think politicians didn't understand yet, that there could be a tremendous political payoff for using abortion as a wedge issue. And the more they understood that, the more activists changed their rhetoric and even sometimes their priorities to court these politicians. And I think that's created a toxic cycle. What you find is that a lot of people who are either pro-life or pro-choice, who have nuanced positions, who find this to be a hard issue, don't really find a movement that speaks to their beliefs. or really often politicians who speak to their beliefs. And once you make something a political issue, you're left with sound bites and all the nuance fades away. So I think that Reagan becoming a pro-life president was the beginning of a kind of ugly chapter in our history.
So we have the Hyde Amendment, which has all been re-upped and re-upped many, many times. And why is that significant?
The Hyde Amendment was the first big victory for the anti-abortion movement. It was a ban on the Medicaid funding of abortion. And it was, I think, also a transformation of what we mean when we say abortion is a privacy right. So initially people thought, okay, even if this is a right to be free from the government, that doesn't mean that the government can't step in and help women and children, both born and unborn. When the Hyde Amendment passed, the big winning argument for it was, if this is a privacy right, the government doesn't have to pay for anything, whether that's abortion or childcare or childbirth. And after that, both sides in the abortion debate have really relied heavily on that argument, that what this is all about is the government staying out of something it shouldn't be doing. Whether if that's pro-life, that might be killing babies. If you're pro-choice, that's women's business. But the possibility of government actually doing something positive to reduce the need for abortion has become a lot harder to talk about politically.
The book is After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. Mary Ziegler is the author. She is a law professor at Florida State University College of Law. And this book is by Harvard University Press. Mary, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flab and David Martin Davies. Our engineer is Doug DeMore. Management and oversight provided by News Director Shelley Koffler and VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation and the GAC Health Foundation.